Welcome, everyone, to episode 428 of the NBA podcast. I'm Brian Toporek, and the playoffs have started. We had, honestly, the best first weekend of playoff basketball that I can remember. So today, we are going to break down the top takeaways from every game one and look ahead to a couple game twos as well. Before we get into that, a reminder that you can follow us on Twitter, at the NBA pod. In our bio, you can find our Twitter handles to give us a follow as well. You can also find us on iTunes and wherever else podcasts are found. On iTunes, please subscribe, download, leave some five-star reviews. We're being hosted on Spreaker, so check them out on Twitter at Spreaker. And we are recording our show today on Locker Room, the only live audio social network for sports fans. Listen to our show on Locker Room before it hits your iTunes feed, engage with us in real time, or start your own room to react to the draft, trade news, and more. Take the mic and download Locker Room in the Apple App Store. Joining me today is a man who got to watch basketball at a reasonable time this weekend, Morten Jensen. How are you?
I'm doing well. Now, granted, I cannot find the time to watch every single game.
Sure.
I just can't. So I'm watching the early games and then one of the late ones if I feel the need to it. And then I'm just hitting the hay. I wanted desperately to wake up on Sunday to watch Blazers Nuggets. But of course it got spoiled because that's just the way it happens in my life. People reach out and they're like, oh, they watch the game. And here's the thing. People ask me sometimes, why don't you just not look at your phone?
Right.
But I also know there could be messages from my boss, colleagues, like family. Like I have to check my phone, damn it. Like I get that watching an NBA game is almost a 3-hour commitment.
Yes.
Like waking up and not looking at your phone for 3 hours? Come on.
Yeah. Even the condensed version, you're still logging at least an hour and a half. So, yeah.
Right. Exactly.
Yeah. That should be a message to everyone. Stop texting more in the mornings about basketball games. No text until at least, what, noon? Is noon fair?
Like 3 p.m., then we're sure.
Oh, good because Lord.
Here's the thing. I have two kids, man.
Yeah. Yeah, yeah, yeah. That's fair. Well, yeah, I also...
You say that now. Look, I'm planning on moving to Hawaii when I retire because that way I can watch all the games.
Yeah.
All the games.
I know. Well, I mean, between being on East Coast time now and having a 2-month-old kid, I am also not watching every single game live. The late-night games I am watching the next morning. So, yeah. With apologies to Blazers Nuggets, I don't think I'll watch more than 30 minutes of that series live.
And that frustrates me because that was an excellent series a couple years ago. And so far, from what I've read about game one, it's living up to the hype again.
Oh, no, it was really good. I'm just not going to watch it the next morning. And I don't really care about the spoilers. But before we're just going to go straight in order more of how the games were played throughout the weekend. So we'll start with Heat Bucks, the rematch from the Eastern Conference semifinals last year. For most of this game, it was looking like, really? The Bucks really chose to play the Heat? Like, they actively did not tank in that late regular season game? But the Bucks prevailed in overtime. Jimmy Butler hit a clutch shot to send it to overtime. And then Chris Money Middleton coming through in the end. Giannis had a decent game, bad at the free throw line, and had a controversial call against him. So let's start there, Mort. The 10-second at the free throw line call, Giannis has been stretching that to the limit all year. It gets called in this game. What did you think of that coming at such a crucial time in the game?
I generally think that if refs were to really upheld that rule, there's like 50 NBA players that should get violations every single time they take a free throw.
Yeah. Yeah. Well, they pointed out on the broadcast, Caron Butler, one of the Heat assistant coaches, was like yelling at a ref. I guess that must have been in the advanced scouting report that Giannis does take a lot of time. So he was like clearly telling them, count. Like, this has been 10 seconds. The inconsistency with officiating was certainly a theme throughout the weekend, I'll say that much.
Yeah, I think that's fair. Yeah.
What did you think about Mr. Stupidly Locked In, Jimmy Butler, going 4 of 22 from the field?
Okay, so I saw your tweet. Were you making fun of that?
Yeah.
Honestly, I think he was stupidly locked in. He wasn't connecting on his shots. That's one thing. I mean, because you're locked in, that doesn't automatically mean that you're going to make shots. Defensively, he was outstanding.
Yeah.
Like, he played from an, like, you know, he played an All-NBA, or sorry, not, an All-Defensive First Team caliber game, for sure. He was fantastic. But he just didn't get the ball to drop, and that was, you know, that was really all she wrote. I mean, if Jimmy didn't have the off-shooting night, they would have taken this one because they found a way to slow down the Bucks. This was a great defensive game on both sides, honestly.
Yes.
I mean, I saw so many guys on Twitter make the point, you know, if you're an old schooler who keeps complaining about the NBA isn't physical enough or doesn't play enough defense, like, you can't complain when you're watching that game. You just can't. That was taken straight out of the 90s.
Yeah. Yeah, no, it was a hard-fought game. It set the tone for the playoffs, for sure. The Heat outshot the Bucks 60-15 in terms of points came from three-pointers more. So they had a 45-point advantage from the three-point line, and the Bucks still won. So looking ahead to Game 2, which is tonight at 7:30, how are you feeling? I mean, you know, you could really argue that both teams should be feeling pretty good because, as you said, if Jimmy Butler doesn't shoot 4-22, they win that game. But the Bucks probably come back and say, well, we're not going to get outshot by 45 from deep.
Right. Right. No, I mean, this is one of those series that's going to be tough. I think for Milwaukee, I love that they're getting this challenge early because it's going to ramp them up for the rest of the playoffs. This is not going to be one of those walkover things. I do expect one game at some point to be a blowout just by the sheer fact that sometimes teams just doesn't show up. It happens.
Yeah.
But whether that's tonight, whether that's game three, I don't know. But I do expect these two teams to, over the course of the full series, to be somewhat evenly matched. Like, yeah, you brought it up. They didn't hit, the Bucks didn't hit threes. They weren't really that explosive offensively. And then Jimmy on the other end really couldn't respond with the offensive efficiency. So if you just count out the fact that those two are likely to align a little bit more in game two, we're looking at a similar situation as game one.
Yeah, I think it certainly, and Bam Adebayo too was 4-15 from the field. So yeah, if the Heat's two best players actually connect on shots, Tyler Hero 2-10, but at the same time, is Goran Dragic going to go 10-17 again? You know, Duncan Robinson was great, hit 7 threes. Not that you can't necessarily count on him to stay efficient from three, but I don't know that you can count on 7 threes from him, especially, you know, I think there were some defensive breakdowns early from the Bucks. He hit three of those very early in that game, and they started to pay more attention to him as the game went on. So in terms of adjustments, more, do you think either team needs to make any drastic moves ahead of game two, or should both teams feel pretty good about where they're at?
No, there is one thing I want to see specifically, and you brought up Bam Adebayo. He was given a lot of space throughout the course of game one, and he just did not utilize it whatsoever. He could have popped, I want to say, around 12 mid-range pull-ups if he wanted to, and I would actually encourage him to take that shot. I think he's got a good enough form. I think he's a good enough shooter to take those. And he routinely turned those downs. Also, Jimmy, at times, I know he shot poorly, but there are times when he was just too unselfish, I want to say, where he had a chance to go for like the drive, like with a somewhat open lane, and instead he kind of turned that down, trying to get a better shot from someone else. I just think they need to be a little bit more aggressive, a little bit more selfish. So when they have an open shot, take it. Don't overthink it. Just take it. And if the Bucks are giving you all that space, utilize it. You don't need to just stand around looking and trying to find cutters and find players who move off the ball. No, if you're open, take the damn shot.
Yeah, I mean, for all the talk we had throughout the season about the Bucks experimenting defensively especially, they opened and dropped coverage, and you're right. They were trying to go, it seemed like they were trying to go Jimmy and Bam into taking mid-range jumpers because, yes, Bam can hit those shots, but I think, you know, that's not necessarily his strong suit. you're much more scared of him around the basket. You're much more scared of Jimmy Butler around the basket. Like, Jimmy Butler wouldn't be a Sixer if he didn't forget how to shoot. So the one half a year in Philly really paid off because, yeah, the shot, I mean, it's crazy how effective he can be despite that part of his game just withering. But it really has.
Yeah.
So, I think you're right that Jimmy could be more aggressive, but I think a lot of the shot selection for him was not ideal in game one. So, like, should he
have... Well, he took 9 threes, so you're right. But, like, the mid-range Jimmy, no pun intended, I don't mind him taking that. That's okay. Like, a free-throw line jump shot? Hell yeah.
But he took some, like... It felt like he just forced a lot. Like, some things that he was either, like, off balance or he was, like, cutting to the basket. They broke up his driving lane and he, like, faded away from the corner. Like, there was just a lot of, even some, like, weird floaters off the backboard. It just felt like he was trying to, you know, I guess break their spirits early by hitting those shots, which makes sense. But a lot of it felt a little too forced. Yeah.
Yeah. So, and it became more forced later in the game because Bam just didn't do anything, really.
Yeah.
I think that was a response as well. And that's why I think it's important that Bam takes those shots.
Yeah.
Like, he might not knock down every single one of them, but you know in a playoff setting, if he just knocks down 3/4 of those shots, I mean, that's enough for you to think about contesting, go out a little bit, and it's 4 shots that Jimmy Butler doesn't have to create. So they just have to come out and be a little more decisive is probably the better word.
Yeah. I also would like to shout out both Drew Holiday, because he is going to be a major difference maker in this series. Yes. He was fantastic in game one. Also, shout out to Coach Bud. 45 minutes for Giannis and Chris Middleton in game one. I know it went into overtime, but overtime is only 5 minutes. So 40 minutes in game one. He learned. He learned from last year.
Both teams were absolutely gassed because of how much they played defensively. Like, good Lord, they were just completely drained right before the game.
Yeah.
You could sense it.
Yeah. All right, Mort, so let's move on to the second game from Saturday, Clippers-Mavericks. And man, oh man, have the Clippers storylines already started. Luka was phenomenal, 31 points, 11 assists, 10 rebounds. Playoff P came back in the first half, was not great. I think it was 1 of 7 from the field in the first, but then came back in the second, finished with 23 points, 6 rebounds, 5 assists. Kawhi was his usual good self, 26 points, 10 rebounds, 5 assists. But the Mavericks take home court advantage with a 113-103 victory. So, what did you think about the Clippers' defense on Luka in particular?
I honestly think they're getting a bum rap on Twitter right now. It's the whole narrative about the Clippers failing again, yada, yada, yada. I think they tried to do the best that they could. I think they threw mostly the right guys at him. Paul George saw minutes on him. Kawhi saw minutes on him. Marcus Morris saw minutes on him. Nicholas Batum saw minutes on him. And those are the 4 players that I think primarily you need to put on Luka. But let's also realize something. Just because you have certain guys on the floor, that doesn't mean that you can put whoever you want on him, because you then Luka will call for a screen and he will call for a screen for whoever has the weakest defender on him, who'll come up, set the screen. The Clippers will switch. Usually that means Zubac taking over Luka, and Luka will be cookies. I got that.
Yeah, and that's what happened early on, especially Luka got cooking against Zubac in particular, and I think after the game, I think someone asked Ty Lue about that. Like, why didn't you put Kawhi on Luka more? And he said that regardless, Luka is just going to force a switch to get a weaker defender on him.
Exactly. Which is the point of the game. So that this is what I would like to see going into game two. I want to see Marcus Morris play center, because here's the thing. You're not too concerned about Kristaps either way.
Right.
Like, he's on the perimeter anyway.
Mm-hmm.
Like, he's not going to go in there and get 15 to 20 post touches per game. Like, that's not going to happen. Mm-hmm. That's not his game.
No.
Start Marcus Morris at center. Play Kawhi at the 4, Paul George at the 3, Batum at the 2, and then I guess Pat Bev at the one?
Yeah, I mean,
I don't love Pat Bev on Luka, but I'll take it if that's the worst I can get.
Like, right. Yeah, I mean,
then you're switching onto him for five guys who can do damage.
Yeah. I'm looking at, this is the matchup data from NBA.com, so take it with a grain of salt. But
right,
Luka, I mean, they threw a number of different guys spent time on Luka. Batum had the most. Beverly, George, Kawhi, Zubac, even Rondo. Against Zubac, Luka shot 6 of 9 from the field. So yeah. Then against everyone else, let me do some quick math here. That's 5 of 15, I believe. So
yeah,
other than him forcing that switch, they actually did do pretty well. And he was 3 of 6 from three against Zubac as well. So yeah, I think they need to. I mean, we said this going into the series was you have Paul George and Kawhi Leonard. One of those guys should probably be on Luka for most of the time. As much as you can avoid having him force a switch onto a weaker defender, like I hear you on starting Morris, but I would really try, if I have two lockdown wing defenders, I would really try to make sure one of those guys was on Luka the whole time. They
of course.
They changed things up in the second half. They started throwing doubles at him or trying to trap him. And then, you know, he's such a good passer that's where Tim Hardaway Jr. and Dorian Finney-Smith especially started knocking down some big shots as well. So
I have something about that.
Yeah.
I have something about that. Mm-hmm. So I'm part of a couple DM groups on Twitter, mostly with Europeans, also one with just Danes. And we're laughing a little bit when we saw that, because people who really paid attention to Luka when he played in Spain fully understand just how adept he is at handling double teams. Yeah. And for some reason, despite this being his third year in the NBA, it still seems as though teams really haven't recognized just how amazing he is at reading the floor. You're doing yourself a disservice if you're double teaming Luka Doncic. You shouldn't. Because that is just going to end up badly. He will find the open player just because of the poise that he has, the calm that he has. I'm not going to mention his name, but one guy in that group was like, after it happened a couple times, was like, man, these teams really don't know how to guard a Euro, do they? Because, I mean, it's something that gets drilled into European basketball in particular, is just how to handle double teams at a very, very early age. Mm-hmm. It's something that American basketball players actually only get to when they're probably in high school or at a later point. Double teams isn't really a major focus in player development, but it is over here. So whenever you have a guy like Luka and you decide, oh, let's throw an extra defender on him, you are essentially making him smile and go, thank you. You're playing right into his hand.
Right.
I mean, double team Luka.
It we'll get to it in a little bit, but it's the complete opposite of what the Blazers did against Jokic. Like, if you play the pass and force him to score, he might go. I mean, he had 31 points. He was pretty efficient, so I can understand.
34?
Doncic, I mean.
Oh, sorry. Yeah, Doncic had 31. Yeah, okay.
But, like, I can understand the reluctance, you know, especially as toward the end of the first half. Like, he was really heating up, and it felt like, okay, this guy could snowball and get 50 if we keep up this defensive tactic. But at the same time, getting his teammates involved, like, if he's both scoring at a high rate and getting his teammates involved and hitting them for open threes in particular, that's where it starts to really snowball. So I agree with you that, you know, again, you have two elite wing defenders in Paul George and Kawhi Leonard. Trust those guys to do that job and keep it one-on-one as much as you possibly can. And if Luka goes off as a scorer, that's one thing, but at least you're not leaving wide open guys to knock down what's probably going to be mostly corner threes.
Question.
Yeah.
You know how everything has turned into switching nowadays?
Yes.
Would it be better for the Clippers to actually not switch on Luka pick and rolls and just have Paul George and Kawhi, for example, those two primarily, because they are better defenders than Batum and Marcus Morris, just try to fight over the screen or go under?
Yeah, I mean, Luka improved as a three-point shooter this year relative to his first 2 years, but like, I wouldn't want to necessarily go under all the time. He is not Ben Simmons in that regard, but you could try it, and if he's feeling it from deep, then you could start to go over. But yes, I agree with you. Like, I would really, really, really do everything in my power to make sure we're not getting, like, Nicholas Batum to be the one who spent the most time on Luka, which is what happened in game one. Or Pat Bev, who I love Pat Bev, but he's not Paul George. He's not Kawhi Leonard. He doesn't have the size to contest Luka like those two guys can. And, I mean, that's the ball game for the Clippers. If you stop Luka, you're winning the series. If you don't, you're going home early and you're facing a ton of questions about your future.
One final note about Luka before we move on.
Mm-hmm.
I'm thinking that, you know, you and I had him as our MVP going into this year.
Yeah.
I am beginning to think that Luka might be one of those guys who at most wins one MVP because, and don't get, that sounds sacrilegious and Dallas fans are going to be on my ass for just saying that, but listen to my reasoning first and foremost. He is not someone who cares about the regular season. He is already the type of guy who is a playoff performer and plays for the playoffs.
Mm-hmm.
This guy is 22 years old, and it took LeBron 10 years to get through that whole, oh, screw the regular season mindset.
Yeah.
He has that already. Yeah. Like, he does not care about the regular season whatsoever. Like, you can sense here in the playoffs, it becomes way more fun to him. He is so much more, I don't know, locked in, engaged. Mm-hmm. I don't know what the wording is, but you can sense this playoff thing is just, I like this. This is where I'm supposed to be. And I wouldn't be shocked if he's just, like, going to have, you know, of course he's still going to produce in the regular season, but I don't think necessarily that he's going to go out of his way, you know, to exert all of his energy in that part of the year. I think this is going to be where we know Luka the best. I think it's going to be the playoffs where he shines the most.
Yeah, he's definitely a big game player and, you know, really likes this spotlight. If you're the Clippers, Mort, you've lost home court advantage. You're down 1-0. I don't want to say that game two is a must-win game, but
I'll say it.
Yeah, if you go down 2-0 and you're heading to Dallas for two, things are not looking great. So how are you feeling if you're a Clippers fan? Do you think, like, you know, we're just going to trust that we're going to right the ship in game two, or are you ready to hit the panic button?
No. The panic button should be untouched. I'm not there whatsoever. I think that would be unnecessary and dramatic for no reason. I trust that they have two guys who on any given night can beat the very best in the league.
Mm-hmm.
And for them, I think it becomes a question of one thing, getting the defense right. Now they have, you know, a full game of having to go back and looking at all their errors. Like, why switch with Luka? Why double team him? Let's remove those aspects immediately. And then I kind of want Kawhi to get more involved. So he had 26, 10, and 5. That's obviously a great line. Kawhi is the type of guy who kind of sticks between, you know, 15, 25, maybe 30 points. There isn't really a great area outside of those. Like, he doesn't really go below 15 points. He doesn't really go below way above 30. Like, he's very much that, you know, that mindset of, we're a consistent production, which is great. That's admirable. Mm-hmm. But the guy's career high in both the regular season and the playoffs is 45. I want Kawhi to come in a little bit more aggressive offensively. And, like, go for 35, 40 points. Mm-hmm. Like, chase that. Because he is so efficient at both around the basket, as a shooter. He's someone who can consistently create his own offense. Not necessarily off the dribble all the time, although he's gotten way better at that. But just by cutting, reading patterns and all that, he's still, on some level, a little bit of a reluctant scorer.
Mm-hmm.
Where, when you look at his body type, when you look at his skill set, I mean, who in the hell do Dallas have that can slow him down? Their best perimeter defender right now, it's probably Josh Richardson or Dorian Finney-Smith.
I was going to say Finney-Smith, probably.
Yeah. Those two, like, right? But, I mean, Kawhi would own both of those guys. Like, if he's aggressive from the start and if he, like, puts it into himself, like, you know what? I am going for 40 tonight. I am going for a 20-point quarter at some point. Just For Kawhi, it's about shot volume. I want him to take more shots. I want him to be more aggressive. And I also think that would help Paul George, because when Paul is like trying to take over the game, which, God, he really tried to do that at times in game one.
Yeah.
I think him having the ability to play off of Kawhi would be so much better. Could you imagine the Mavs throwing a double at Kawhi and him hitting a wide open PG on the perimeter?
Yeah.
Like, those are the shots that could get him going. So I want to see Kawhi just be way more aggressive in game two. Go for 40. Go for 50. I don't care. Just be more aggressive.
Yeah, I don't want to say it felt like load management, Kawhi, because he played a ton of minutes, but
right.
It didn't feel like he was in game seven of the finals or anything. You know, like he's easing his
way. Well, he were in game right. one of a first round matchup.
Right. I think he was feeling his way out, and now that he's seen. I mean, they saw him last year too, but now that he's seen what he's up against, I expect a much better performance out of really both guys. I mean, it's great that Paul George found his footing in the second half. That should give him confidence moving forward and the Clippers confidence moving forward. But my hand is like hovering over the panic button. I'm not hitting it yet, but if they lose game two, I am slamming it.
Oh, yeah, yeah. If they hit game two, then we can talk about the panic button.
Yeah.
But right now, I mean, look, I think we never really gave the Clippers enough credit during the regular season.
Right.
So for us to panic just for a game one loss, that to me is just being extremely disrespectful to what they did over the course of the season.
Yeah.
But if they fail to win game two, then we can at least broach the subject and we can talk about it.
Yeah. Yeah. It is worth noting how many teams, you know, home teams often lose game one and then go on to like sweep the rest of the series. So
right.
for any team that lost game one, it's too early to panic. Or any home team that lost game one, is too early to panic.
Right. Right.
What team, I'm not panicking about them, but I think this series, the next one that played out about as you expected, Nets Celtics, the big three of Brooklyn combined for 82 points, Kevin Durant 32, Kyrie 29, James Harden 21, 9 rebounds, 8 assists. The Celtics started well, and like this was such a weird game because they were within striking distance for most of it. But it never really felt like they had a chance, especially they went cold in the second half. Tatum finished 6 of 20. You know, Kemba, 5 of 16. Fournier, 3 of 10. We got 9 blocks out of Robert Williams, so that's a bright side. But, you know, the Nets didn't even feel like they ran much cohesive offense for most of this game. It was basically like you take turns iso-balling.
Yeah. Yeah.
But they just have enough firepower, especially against an undermanned Celtics team without Jaylen Brown, that it's not going to matter.
I would agree with that. I mean, look, if it hadn't been for Boston's second quarter, we would have been looking at a full-on blowout.
Yeah.
Really, that's really what it boils down to. And I'm kind of concerned a little bit that it turned into this your turn, my turn kind of thing for the Nets.
Mm-hmm.
Like, I understand right now they can go to it because Boston is not going to come away with this series. They're not. They're just so undermanned because of the loss of Jaylen Brown. So right now you can get away with it. But are those really, like, the practices you want to preach right now when you're going to make a long-term, like, playoff run? Is that the mythology you want to use? I'm skeptical of that. I don't think that really is. When has that ever worked? I mean, even if we go back to LeBron's Heat, the reason they lost against the Mavs were because they were playing your turn, my turn basketball.
Right.
It wasn't until the year later they were like, oh, wait a second. We have to develop a system.
Yeah.
And it has to make sense. That they suddenly began winning. And even when they lost to the Spurs that fourth year, they reverted back to playing your turn, my turn basketball, and the Spurs just feasted on it. So I don't think that a guy like Kevin Durant, who has been a part of several championship teams, I know Kyrie Irving has done so as well, but I don't think he's satisfied. I think he's going to come in and basically say, no, this is not how we played in Golden State. This is not how we operated. We had a system. We had certain rules. We had certain roles as well. Let's see if we can try to implement that. So I hope for the Nets' sake that in game two, we're going to be seeing a more cohesive unit.
Yeah, I mean, Harden had 8 assists, but they only had 18 assists on 35 made field goals as a team. And, you know, really for all three guys, but especially Harden, there were a couple where he would just, like, dribble into a three with plenty of time left on the shot clock. And it's just like, you have Kevin Durant and Kyrie Irving, Blake Griffin as well, and Joe Harris. Like, you have to be able to create a better possession than a step-back three. I know you can hit that shot, and I know it's one of your patented moves, but you were doing that in Houston where you were playing with, like, Eric Gordon. You're playing with two of the highest level scorers in the league right now. Please try to figure out how to create a better shot than that. Like, it's not going to come to bite them in this series, but right. against Milwaukee it could.
Or again, Milwaukee would love this.
Yeah. So, you know, maybe the Nets use this series as a tune-up because these guys really haven't played a ton together this year, and they're just not going to have a chance to develop the chemistry that you can over a 72-game or 82-game season. So it almost might behoove them, especially if they get out to a 3-0 lead, like maybe lose a game just to give yourself a little bit more time to get used to each other before you're going up against Milwaukee or Miami in the second round, both of whom would feast.
Light years ahead.
Yeah. I don't know, man. I'm not, like, the Nets should feel great because the biggest concern about them is this lack of chemistry. But, like, a lot of the playoffs does come down to, do you have these individual shot creators who can hit ridiculously hard shots? And they have three of them. So,
yeah, they do.
You know, cohesive offense is great, and I agree they're going to need it at some point if they're going to win the title this year. But at the same time, like, having three high-level isolation scorers is going to help bail them out. They can just stop runs, especially KD. Like, if any team is going on a run against them, just give it to KD, and he is more likely than not going to stop it. So, you know, I think a lot of these series challenge some of our prior assumptions coming in. This one did not. We know how this one's going to end. And it's, you know, I think it's, we have to play it out just because who knows, injuries or God forbid could change the outlook. But otherwise, it just feels like Boston's still drawing dead here.
Yeah. It really does. They're dead in the water. I think for them, this is really about development. Honestly,
yeah.
I mean, Robert Williams almost getting a triple-double with 11, 9, and 9, and 9 of them being blocks. Aaron Nesmith. Nesmith? I'm really confused. Now I'm hearing that it's pronounced a different way. You know what? NBA announcers need every summer to attend some sort of class, online class,
about pronunciation.
Yeah. Because when we hear, like, 15 different announcers use 15 different pronunciations, I get confused. I need something stable. I can't figure that out. But, yeah, no. Robert Williams, Nesmith, Pritchard, those are the guys that have to be moving forward as rotation pieces for the Celtics. Grant Williams, I just don't know about. I mean, like, there are a lot of smaller intricacies that I like, but he just does not produce a whole lot. So I'm not really crazy about retaining him. So maybe this is just a question of let's use these playoffs to figure out who do we keep, who do we move off of.
Yeah, that's fair. Because they have a lot of, we'll save their bye Felicia for another time, probably next week at this rate. But they have a lot of really tough decisions coming up, and they are in a bad financial place. But we'll get there later.
Yeah.
Okay, let's go to Blazers Nuggets. Mort, as you mentioned, Jokic got going as a scorer, 34 points. He had 16 rebounds, 1 assist.
Yeah.
Which is just shocking for a guy who is averaging almost 9 per game during the regular season. And I think that's the story of game one. The Blazers win 123-109. You know, Dame is phenomenal, 34 points. Nurkic, 16 points, 12 rebounds. McCollum, 21. And Carmelo, it's 18 off the bench. But really, it's Nikola Jokic, 1 assist. And they said afterwards, that was our strategy. We were going to play him. We're not going to throw doubles at him. We're not doing what the Clippers did to Luka. We're going to play him straight up. We have Kanter. We have Nurkic. And we don't want him to get going as a playmaker. It's similar to, I mean, this is what we've seen teams do against LeBron over the years too. And, you know, it's a pick your poison thing because Jokic is such a good scorer. Like, he's so efficient. But that's when the Nuggets are at their most dangerous, is when he's getting his teammates involved. So what did you think about the Blazers' strategy in Game 1, and how did the Nuggets adjust going into Game 2?
So full disclosure, I only saw one of those 15-minute condensed games. I didn't see the long condensed games because, like, when a game is spoiled for me, I just can't.
Yeah.
I tune out. I mentally just check out if I know the result. For some reason, I just can't. I don't know what it is. But what I did see was that, of course, they were just giving him every opportunity to get going offensively himself. And then when you look at the box score, you're also seeing the 27 shots, because those condensed games, they only show the makes, which is a little bit frustrating. But 27 shots for Jokic, that's not his game. That's never been his game. He does not like to be a high-volume scorer, shooter, at all. He wants to settle into that 16 to 18, maybe 20 on a good night kind of thing, and he didn't. So by forcing him to become a scorer, you're actually also bringing out the worst in him, because he doesn't want to be that. You're basically forcing him to do something that goes against how he prefers to play the game of basketball, and I think that matters, because, like, yeah, he can score. He was averaging, what, 26 over the course of the regular season, so I'm not saying he can't score. He obviously can, but there has to be a balance, and he's a guy who lives very much on balance, and look, the Blazers just upset that balance. And when you can do that to a team, or just to the primary player on an opposing team, you've won. I mean, that is completely changing the fabric of who he is as a player during a game. So in Game 2, I expect things to be a lot different. A lot different. They are going to find ways to get him going as a passer. They're going to get him the ball in different areas than he might have gotten in Game 1. This is going to be a total adjustment for Game 2.
Yeah, I mean, again, we talked about it going into the series. This is where not having Jamal Murray really hurts, because that's an obvious outlet for his passing. You know, with all due respect to Austin Rivers, who has started and played 33 minutes in this game, and Facundo Campacho, like, those aren't guys you want to lean on playing 30-plus minutes a game in a playoff series. You know, Monte Morris had 10 points off the bench. Your boy Marcus Howard did play 20 minutes, 7 points there, but I mean, it feels like the key is Michael Porter Jr. Like, if they're going to really play Jokic as a scorer and limit him as a passer, you know, MPJ had 25 points, but he shot only 1 of 10 from deep, which I don't think you can expect.
And no free throws.
Yeah.
21 shot attempts and 0 free throws.
I mean, they only had 8 free throw attempts as a team.
Yeah. I saw on Twitter that Denver fans were upset at that. And again, I didn't see the full game, so I'm asking you, who did.
Yeah.
Was it a fair whistle? Was it unfair? Because I obviously watching this one on a condensed feed, that doesn't show the whole story. So what was it? Was it bad?
It didn't strike me as egregious.
Okay.
I mean, you know, every fan is going to think their team is getting jobbed by calls, but
that's why I ask. Yeah. Like, if they had a legit gripe, or if it was just, you know, fans being upset.
Yeah, no, I think it's more that.
Okay.
You know, I do think you're right. Like, MPJ should not have 0 free throw attempts. That's an issue, and you're going to need to get that fixed in Game 2. I think that's really the key, is just, can you get, you know, Aaron Gordon too? Like, he had 16 points on 7 of 16 shooting, but if they really are going to play Jokic as a scorer and single cover him, like, you know, again, you don't have this floor spacing that you did when you have Jamal Murray on the floor. So that certainly hurts, but I don't think you are going to depend on Michael Porter Jr. going 1 of 10 from 3. Like, he is such a high-level scorer that he could easily go for 35 or 40 in this game, and if you've got 30 from Jokic, you know, that's, what, 65, 70 points right there.
Yeah.
So this is really, again, this is, you know, I picked the Blazers going into this series because I thought being without Murray in particular really evened the table here. And I don't necessarily think the Nuggets are going to lose Game 2. They could very easily tie this series up. But they might have the right personnel to, give the Nuggets trouble in this series. Yeah.
Also not helping is the fact that it took them 93 shots to score 109 points. If you look at the top three guys, like Jokic, Porter, Gordon, 16 points on 16 shots. Porter Jr., 25 on 21. I mean, hell, it even took Jokic 27 shots to score 34. Mm-hmm. That is not super efficient scoring basketball. So I also have to assume, because those three guys are just a lot better than that, that they will bounce back a little bit in game two.
Yeah, I would think so as well. Okay, let's go to Sunday's games, Mort. We tipped off with the barn burner that was Sixers-Wizards. Actually ended up being closer than I think a lot of people expected, myself included. Part of that was Joel Embiid getting into foul trouble. He only played 10 minutes in the first half because the referees also tailgated before the game and called some truly egregious. The second and third fouls on him were ridiculous, but Tobias Harris, in the meantime, came through with 28 first-half points. I jinxed the hell out of Tobias Harris. He finished with 37, and he had 35 with 10 minutes left. And I was like, oh, this is more points than I remember Tobias Harris scoring. So I went on StatHead and looked it up. His career high was 39. So I tweeted out, with 10 minutes left, he needs 4 or 5 points to top his career high. He scored 2 more, finished with 37. So I'm sorry, Tobias, but I mean, we have to start there, Mort. He was just absolutely phenomenal. The Wizards had no answer for him. Their best answer was him for him was having him run out of gas because he scored so at will in the first half. So,
yeah.
You know, they already have a lot of issues guarding Embiid. All three of their centers got into foul trouble very quickly against him. How do they stop both Embiid and Harris now?
Well, I don't think Harris is going to go for 37 in game two necessarily.
Yeah, fair.
But at the same time, I also don't think Ben Simmons is going to, you know, score just 6 points.
Ask Sixers Twitter about that.
I know. Look, you know, I think we have to have that conversation as well. I tweeted out because on the first, I think it was the first player of the game, might have been the second play of the game for the Sixers, he like rushed down into the paint and had like a quick little hook shot and was like, we're going to have that kind of game? Nice! And then I guess, like, just gone. I just used a Danish term there. He just goes away. And again, he's great in the open court from a passing perspective. Like, hell, look, some of the passes he made. Tremendous. Yeah.
15 assists.
He has 15 assists and 15 rebounds.
Yeah.
Well, 6 points. Yeah. He has to understand that when he has Russell Westbrook, Raul Neto, or Bradley Beal on him, like, that's cookies.
Yeah.
Get into the damn, like, paint. And I'm not being... The reason I'm actually yelling at Ben Simmons despite a win is because I know fully well that it's not sustainable to ask Tobias Harris to do the same right. that he did in game one.
Right.
At the same time, it's also fair to say Joel Embiid could get into foul troubles again. You know, he had 30 points in 30 minutes. He's obviously tremendously productive when he's playing. But you know what? He does have a chance to throw an elbow here and there. He does have this tendency to make some boneheaded mistakes. And sometimes he will get called out on it and he'll go to the bench for an extended period of time, in which case you just cannot rely on one guy to get the offense going. So to answer your question about Washington, if assuming Joel is not in foul trouble, they can't do jack.
Yeah.
They can't do anything. Of course they can. It's no, Robin Lopez can't. Daniel Gafford, who from a box score perspective played really well, 12.6 rebounds, 6-6 from the floor. You know, he is just a garbage man. Trust me, I watched him plenty in Chicago. I've seen the whole narrative flip around him, but you would be surprised just how much he wouldn't be able to produce if he didn't have guard playmakers alongside him as well.
Yeah. A lot of those points were just lobs or, you know, off of rebounds.
Right.
Yeah. He did not create. It's not like he's Embiid facing up and shooting mid-range jumpers in crunch time. Yeah.
Exactly. And I think the Sixers are going to focus on that because, look, regardless of how you get your buckets, shooting 6 out of 6 in 20 minutes, that is not helping your situation. So I think Doc is going to go in with the game film and going, you know what, we just can't give him those easy shots near the basket. We just can't. We got to box him out.
Yeah.
And I think they need to look at Dwight a little bit more for that. I think they need to look a little bit more at Joel and just saying, no. We cannot let Daniel Gafford, of all people, come in and do this sort of damage.
Yeah, Embiid said after the game that he had to play somewhat conservatively after he came back in the third quarter because he had the three fouls, and then when the fourth quarter came around and he still only had three fouls, that allowed them to be a little more aggressive defensively, him and Ben in particular against Beal. Late in the game, I thought were great. You know, Matisse had a typical Matisse game. Great defense, absolutely nothing on offense. To your point
about... Literally,
yeah.
0 points.
But... one assist, so I guess technically something. But yeah, two steals, two blocks in 14 minutes. To your point about Ben, I agree. Like, he is just going to be a divisive player until he starts shooting jump shots, which might not happen for a while. But like,
no, screw the jump shots. That's not important. I just want him to get into the teeth of the defense.
I know. I'm just saying in general. But no, I agree. Like, that... I think it was the second or third possession of the game. I know exactly what you're talking about. And I, too, was like, oh, okay, we're getting aggressive, Ben, today. But yeah. I think it was a testament to the Wizards' transition defense in particular. Like, they know that is how Ben Simmons is going to kill you, so you need to form a wall quickly if he gets the ball. And I thought they did a pretty good job of it. He didn't have a ton of open looks, and even when... Yeah, I mean, sometimes he did have Beal or Russ on him, and he was backing him down, but then someone would cheat over to make it a little more difficult. And, you know, his natural instinct when that happens, if someone's cheating toward him, that means right. There's an open teammate, and he's going to make that pass 10 times out of 10. So,
But Brian, that wall in the first quarter when you had the starters in consisted of, at best, Alex Len, yeah. Rui Hachimura, Russell Westbrook, Raul Neto, and Bradley Beal.
I know.
How effective can that damn wall be, though?
I know. Yeah. What did you think? I mean, this is going to be the narrative throughout the series. Mm-hmm. Russell Westbrook, we got bad Russ in game one. We had 16 points on 7 of 17 shooting, 6 turnovers, including an absolute backbreaker late. What does he need to do in game two?
Ease up, like always. He had some misses where I was just... what the hell is going on? He had one shot at some point where he hit it, tried to make a bank shot.
Yeah.
It didn't even hit the rim.
It looked like he thought, I don't know, like physics would just somehow cheat and make, that was one of the worst bank shots I've ever seen.
Exactly. And you just have to, like, when I watched that, I was like, is that like, How did that even happen?
Right.
And I don't know if he just gets flustered at times or if he just gets so shot happy that he doesn't really think, or I don't know what it is with him. Like, I was being fairly complimentary of him early, in the late stages of the season, because he absolutely played a lot better than he used to do. I have been a major Russ critic, and to my surprise, he delivered at the end of the regular season, but now we're back to the version that I detest. I mean, 6 turnovers, 7 of 17 from the field, weird shot selection. Defense was not good either, but that's not a surprise. And that's all, again, that is in part why I reached the analysis that I did with Ben Simmons, or the conclusion, rather, that if Russell Westbrook at any point is on you, go at him.
Yeah.
You're 6'10", 240.
Yeah.
Go at him.
Well, I think it was interesting because the Sixers throughout the regular season had Simmons defending Westbrook, and then Green and Matisse typically defending Beal, and Green struggled with that matchup. So they started off Sunday, Green on Westbrook, Simmons on Beal, which makes total sense. Like, Simmons is your best perimeter defender. Beal should be seeing a heavy diet of Simmons and Matisse. But I also thought Green on Westbrook almost felt like they were goading him into taking some of those shots. Like, Danny Green is not going to be able to stick with you necessarily, or you might be able to drive through the rim, but you still have to worry about Embiid. So, like, he was open for a lot of mid-range shots, and he took them, and he hit a couple, to his credit. But I think the Sixers will happily live with Russell Westbrook mid-range shots. Like, if he leads the team in shot attempts, that's a win for the Sixers.
He's the type of guy who really shouldn't take this type of shots that I want Bam Adebayo to take.
Yes.
Yeah.
Yeah.
And also, it didn't really help the Wizards that they had 12 turnovers just between Westbrook and Beal.
No, not ideal. And Beal, I thought, looked pretty good. I thought, especially for how limited he looked during the play-in games, you know, he was saying after the game the hamstring's trending in the right direction. They have 2 days off, and, you know, they play Wednesday and then another 2 days off. They play Saturday for game three. So hopefully we see a healthier Beal throughout the series. But, you know, I'm nowhere near concerned for Philly. Like, you're right. Joel Embiid could get into foul trouble again, but it just hasn't happened all that often. And Doc, after the game, said he thought the second and third fouls were legit. You know, there's not going to be a last 2 minute report for the first, whatever, like, I guess that was the first half. So we won't know. We won't have an official review, but he probably could have challenged one of those and won it. So, I think if there's a really controversial call early and it's the second foul and Embiid in the first quarter, he will learn from this mistake and be quicker to challenge that. So, you know, I'd be surprised if Embiid picks up three first half fouls again at some point in the series, but we'll see.
One final note, by the way. I have to bring it up because it couldn't leave my mind as I was watching the game.
Okay.
Davis Bertans.
Yeah. Oh, yeah. Good. I'm glad you brought him up.
He would look really good in Philly.
Oh, well, I'm glad you brought him up because he was matched up against Seth Curry at times.
Yeah.
And did not take advantage of it.
That's not his game. He's a shooter.
I know, but, I mean, you have 6 inches on the guy.
I know, but that is really not his game.
If they see him matched up against Seth Curry, they should be actively trying to get him an open shot because he's going, like, Seth Curry can't contest that shot.
Oh, you mean on the perimeter? I agree with that. I thought you meant, like, put him in the post.
No.
Like,
okay, attacking off the dribble? No. But, if you see Seth Curry on him.
Oh, shoot. Get him the ball. Yeah, get him the ball. Absolutely. Well, so here's the thing about Bertans as well. He is a guy who can hit the the spot up shot and all that, but he likes to be in movement as well. I don't know what it is. He creates himself a rhythm via his movement, I think. But to that point, yes. I like the way that he shot the ball, the way that he moved around in 28 minutes, I would have wanted him to get more than 10 shot attempts. Absolutely. There were times when I was thinking, just because of how effective he was from behind the arc, like, why are you not running every single play right? Why are you not running him around like Kyle Korver?
Yeah.
I mean, there were times where he just stood still and you were like, what is happening? And it's because they were trying to get Westbrook and Beal going. And I get that. But if you have someone who's hot, who's moving around, who's causing all kinds of havoc with the Sixers defense, you need to go to that option way more. But yeah, my point here was, I couldn't stop thinking of just how much he would give the Sixers if he was traded for, like, and be like the sixth man coming off the bench and just jacking up threes. Mm-hmm. Oh my God, the implementations that you guys could have with him on that roster, like, it would completely minimize Ben Simmons' non-shooting effort. Like,
yeah.
If you can have offensive team units where you have Embiid, Bertans, Harris, Curry, good Lord, man.
Yeah. Yeah. Now, I'm interested to see whether they... I mean, Doc pulled Seth for George Hill late in the game. Because Bertans did hit a couple of those shots early on. And, that's what kept the Wizards in the first half when Tobias Harris was going nuclear. But I'm certainly curious to see how he adjusts to the Bertans Curry mismatch in game two, because good Lord, I saw that. I was like, what is happening here? Why is Seth Curry defending Davis Bertans? I'm glad the Wizards did not take advantage of it.
I am, however, glad that Seth Curry got up 9 threes.
Yes, and especially he had a scary-looking injury in the first half where he just got hit in the stomach. He was fine in the second half and actually played really well, but he went down.
Was it the stomach?
That's what Woj said. I mean, maybe. He was in a lot of pain. We'll just leave it at that. Yeah.
Yeah. It just seems like jingle bells were jingling.
Yes, yes.
Yeah.
All right, let's move on to Suns-Lakers. Speaking of scary-looking injuries, We got to start with Chris Paul, who goes down in the second quarter with a shoulder injury, was in a tremendous amount of pain, was down on the court for a couple minutes, and then...
Suns Twitter panicking.
Yeah, well, I mean, it looked bad. He was...
It did, but I mean, oh my God, like... Did you see the live reactions on Twitter at that point?
I was watching the game. I was in the Sixers post-game press conference, and then I'm on Twitter at the same time, and I just see, like, oh, no, oh, no, oh, no, no, not Chris. No, Chris. Anyone but Chris.
We can't have nice things.
Yeah. And it sucks, right? Because, I mean, this has just been the narrative around his playoff career especially. Like, he just keeps getting hurt at – very inopportune times, and he, to his credit, he does come back in this game, but clearly looked hampered. They called it a right shoulder contusion. He says he's going to be fine for game two, but you know, for a guy with one of the tightest handles in the NBA, he did not have a tight handle yesterday.
I had a tighter handle than Chris Paul did after the injury with the right hand.
And I saw you noted on Twitter, you know, like, he was not pulling for jump shots he typically would. You know, it's a testament to the Suns that despite that injury and despite only getting 7 points from him, they still beat the Lakers 99-90. Devin Booker, sensational, 34 points, 8 assists, 7 rebounds. DeAndre, 8-2 in the battle.
He was arguably more sensational.
Yeah, DA versus AD. Round one goes to DA, 21 points, 16 rebounds. So what did you think of the Suns' performance yesterday, especially in the wake of Chris Paul's injury?
Oh, it was phenomenal. So Paul, even after the injury, hit one of those weird shots where it didn't even look like his shot movement or shot motion whatsoever. Mm-hmm. And it was very fittingly an elbow jump shot, by the way, or a throw-in, or whatever it was that he threw in. But that when he made that shot, it really seemed to lift everyone around him. It's like he's pulling it through. We got to win this one for CP. But no, they were just composed. This was their first playoff game in what? I don't even know. 2006? No, that can't be.
I think it was 10 years.
10 years. Okay. Yeah. Oh, okay. A little bit later. Who the hell am I thinking of? 2006? Is that the Kings? That must be the Kings. Yeah. Well, see, this is where we're at. I'm mistaking the Suns and the Kings because I had those two, like, right? They were so bad for so long.
Yep.
So for them to come in and play their first playoff game in such a long time and be this composed. I mean, Mikal Bridges had a great defensive outing.
Yes.
Aiden was just, he had a great sense of both patience but aggressiveness, if that makes sense. Like, he sought the play, but he wasn't desperate or panicked to get it completed. But then when he got the ball deep or when he got the ball in certain areas or when he saw someone would get into the lane and he had a chance to offensive rebound, put it back in, or go for a lob. He was there. He was on point. He was 10 of 11 from the field. And he just completely out-hustled, out-maneuvered every single big man on the Los Angeles Lakers. Devin Booker scored within the flow of the offense throughout the entire night. At no point did he, like, go all Russell Westbrook and venture outside of those restrictions, which I really give him a ton of credit for. For Devin Booker to come out, I would absolutely understand if he was, like, a little bit sour about all the attention a lot of other players would get, so he would come out and just jack up shots. Mm. He didn't. Like, he just scored within the flow. He rebounded. He playmade. He was just so sound all the way through. It looked like he'd been there before, which I think is super important. What I really want to talk about the Lakers instead, Brian. So the Suns did something that played right into, or sorry, so actually the Lakers did something that played right into the Suns' hands.
Yep.
Because the Suns kept inviting the interior post option for Andre Drummond.
Yes.
And there's a reason the Suns did that. And, like, when people look at the box score, they go, oh, Drummond was good, 12 points, 9 rebounds in 19 minutes, 5 of 7 from the field. No. No. This is one of those, that, like, this is why we say the box score can lie once in a while.
Yep.
He was dreadful. Like, it was just such a tough look to see him do what he did there. And it was, for the Suns, just such a smart play. Basically opening up the lane for him and just go, you know what, that's fine. Go get deep post position. That's cool. Mm-hmm. You can't hit a layup to save your life anyway. So that was really, really smart. And I don't know why Frank Vogel or LeBron James, who's probably the real coach of the team anyway,
yeah,
just didn't go, what the hell are you doing?
I mean,
why are you taking the bait?
Frank Vogel's taking the bait by not playing Anthony Davis in center, and it's going to be a theme throughout the playoffs.
He doesn't want to play center, remember?
We need to talk about Anthony Davis, because that
yes,
was...
Yes, we do.
I made a joke, you know, playoff P is gone, playoff AD is here. Like, that was out. 13 points on 5 of 16 shooting, 7 rebounds, 2 assists in 39 minutes. Like, that's not Anthony Davis.
But remember, he did this in the bubble, too? Remember when we talked about during the bubble play that he had he had played 6 games at that point and 3 of them had been super inefficient? Mm-hmm. We need to talk about that. He actually does this on a somewhat consistent manner.
Well, I know Mason Ginsburg, our friend of the podcast, has been harping on this point that, you know, his mid-range shooting in particular in the bubble was just like out of nowhere sensational. Like, along what Joel Embiid did this year, where it's just like, this is an outlier.
Yeah.
But then the outlier for Anthony Davis has since regressed to the mean, and we are seeing, you know, he was pretty great. I mean, I agree. He had a couple clunkers in the bubble, but, like, he was pretty consistently great throughout the Lakers' playoff run, and I don't think either LeBron or Anthony Davis is completely 100% healthy. So that is certainly a factor, too. I don't want to, you know, disregard the injuries that they're both coming back from. But, you know, Anthony Davis, to his credit, after the game said, you know, he took responsibility. He said, there's no way we're winning a game, let alone a series, with me playing the way I played. But I thought, I got to find this quote. It was so weird. He was like, he said, like, the start of the game is what got him out of rhythm. Like, he thought, yeah, here we go. He said LA's hot start lessened his personal urgency, although they were only up 15-10 4.5 minutes in the quarter. And he said, usually I come out of the gates very dominant, and I think tonight or today we had it going, so I kind of just got lost in the offense. It's like, bro, you had a 5-point lead early in the first quarter, and you're out of rhythm because of that. Like, you're not gonna try to dominate after that. It was just very, very weird game from Anthony Davis.
No, but we need to have that conversation, generally speaking. So, he played 36 games in the regular season, okay? In 13 of those games, he failed to shoot 45% from the field. And in those, that's a pretty substantial amount of games, 13 out of 36. We agree on that, right? Mm-hmm. Okay. In those 13 games, when he failed to shoot over 45% from the field, he only canned 1 3. He was, I haven't done the averages here, but I can tell from his free throw percentages, they were not great as well. He only had double-digit rebounding in 4 of those games. So this is the thing, when he struggles, it's not just the shot-making, it's everywhere.
Yeah.
Like, he doesn't have a single category struggle. When he is out of rhythm offensively, he mentally checks out. He just goes away. Mm-hmm. Like, he does very, very little else. And this has been a pattern of him both in the regular season, and again, we saw it in the bubble. I think it was prior to the playoffs last year. This is not new. He has these games. Now, do I rather want him to have these type of games in the first round than in the finals? Absolutely. Of course. But we need to have the conversation that this is something that can happen on a fairly regular basis.
Mm-hmm.
He is not, and this is why I keep like having an issue with people who put him in the top 3 in the league. Like, oh, he's a top 3 player. No.
Yeah.
Sorry. He's not. He is a great, great two-way player. We can definitely talk about him in the top 10 for sure. Absolutely. And if you really push me, we can talk about top 5, maybe.
Mm-hmm.
But in the upper echelon of, you know, LeBron, Giannis, Kawhi,
Jokic.
No. Yeah. Jokic. Yeah, yeah. I'm sorry. It's because he's international. I keep forgetting him, much like the national writers. No, like, he's not there.
Yeah. Well, I mean, I just saw this stat from Tom Haberstroh on Twitter, so I want to read this. So this is per 36 minutes.
Mm-hmm.
Anthony Davis with Andre Drummond on the court is averaging 19.7 points, 7.5 rebounds, 5.8 free throw attempts per game. He is shooting 38.7 overall, 17.9 from three-point range. With Marc Gasol on the floor, 27.5 points, 9.6 rebounds, 7.4 free throw attempts per game. So again, this just comes down to it. It's what you were saying about Drummond earlier. It's like they're actively choosing to play lineups that don't make sense. Yeah. And I get that Anthony Davis doesn't want to play center, but bro, you played center and won a ring last year. Like, this is, I get it, not wanting to do it during the regular season. And sure, yeah, you don't want to do it against a physical guy like DeAndre Ayton. But at some point, you either probably need to choose, do you want to play center or do you want to get knocked out in the first round? Now, it might not happen because Chris Paul, who knows what his status is. Even if he plays Tuesday, I don't know that we're going to get fully healthy Chris Paul. Hopefully, we see, you know, better than what we got on Sunday. So they might be able to survive this, but it's just, I don't know, if you're going up against Nurkic in the second round or Jokic in the second round, you're going to have to play center at some point.
Can we reword it? I know I said center earlier, but I kind of want to retract that. I don't think it's the position center specifically that's the issue. Mm-hmm. I think it's just him having to be the primary big, whatever that is.
Yeah.
Because it really doesn't... Like, I really think it boils down to the fact that, like, if you played... Who is it they have? They have Markieff Morris, for example, at... And I put him this in quotation marks. Like center. You know, he'll just be spotting up from outside. I just think you cannot have another post presence in there to clog up the lane. He needs to have that somewhat single coverage going for him to really be effective near the basket. Whenever the paint is clogged, that limits him. And then people are like, what about Marc Gasol? Marc Gasol does not spend a whole lot of time backing people down in the paint. He will move away from the basket if he notices that Anthony Davis is initiating a drive or wants to take a shot or get a layup or whatever. He has the smarts to kind of, okay, let me move back. Let me turn myself into a spot-up shooter instead, which you can't do with Andre Drummond. So you just cannot play a traditional big alongside Anthony Davis whatsoever. And for Davis, I think it would behoove the Lakers to just sit down with him and just have the quote-unquote center discussion and just go, you know what, it doesn't really matter what the hell you are. If you want to label a power forward, fine. Mm-hmm. We don't give a damn. That's not what this boils down to. We just want you to be the sole big man on the team who plays in a more traditional sense.
Yeah, and I think, you know, if the good thing for the Lakers is that LeBron and AD both are not, you're not expecting them to play as poorly as they did going into game two. You have a banged up Chris Paul. Like, you should feel good about, even though you lost game one, you were the lower seed, you didn't lose home court advantage. Like, this is not the end of the world here. This was a weird game. You know, you're still probably, let me check actually. I would assume they're still the favorite in this series moving forward. Let's see. FanDuel says, Oh, it's getting closer, but yeah, they are still technically, they're -118. Phoenix is now -104, so they are favored, but not as...
They're only favored because LeBron had a bad game one, and he's going to come out like gangbusters in game two. But you know what? Like, you were talking about the panic button before.
Yeah.
I am closer to the panic button for the Lakers than I am to the Clippers.
Oh, interesting. Okay.
No, but you know why? You know why? Because now, and look, Suns fans, you've been wanting to hear me say kind words about you for a long time now. Here it comes. The Suns are tremendous.
Mm-hmm.
And we have just not given them their due in this series. Like, I actually chose the Lakers going into this, and I am having serious second thoughts about this.
Yeah.
We keep doing this to good teams. We also do it to Utah. I realize they lost, but they were without Donovan Mitchell. We seem to have this thing where a team that we don't really expect to have a really, really good season, we go, oh, that's a nice story, but, oh, they played really well, but... And you know what? We need to stop doing that. At some point, these teams are also so fantastic that we need to give them their due credit. And the Suns right now are one of the best teams in the NBA. Whereas you could argue with the Mavs in the Clippers series, they had a much better second half to the season, but they're not in the same caliber of the Suns or the Jazz, for example. And so why shouldn't I be more panicked on the Lakers? I have a LeBron James who's still working through an ankle issue and also had a little bit of a shoulder thing when Chris Paul apparently decided to even the odds with the shoulder thing.
Yes.
I have an Anthony Davis who apparently checks out because he was up 5 points in a game. I have Andre Drummond, a center who really shouldn't be scoring near the basket, despite it's the only place where he can score. Mm-hmm. I have a point guard in Dennis Schroeder who might have one of the lowest IQs in terms of point guards in the entire NBA. I have KCP, who is one of the most inconsistent shooters, just in terms of rhythm. I have Kyle Kuzma, who the hell knows what I'm getting from him every single night out. I have Wes Matthews, who's approximately 278 years old. And then I have Caruso, who's fine. Why wouldn't I be more close to the panic button here when I'm matched up against a team with Devin Booker, who very much looks like he belongs in a playoff setting, who still has Chris Paul, who's the emotional leader, with DeAndre Ayton, who apparently for the whole season just played possum, and then Jay Crowder, by the way, went 0-for-7 from 3. That's not going to replicate itself. He's going to be better.
Yeah.
And Mikal Bridges shot 4 of 12. That's also not going to replicate itself. He's going to be better offensively, but he already played great defense. Like, what are we talking about here? This Suns team is perfectly matched up against the Lakers. And I understand the reason we're so worried about not picking the Lakers is because they burned us before. Mm. It's LeBron. We don't want to go against LeBron. But you know what? The more we do that, the more we also forget to give credit to good teams. And the Phoenix Suns are a great effing team. Yeah. We need to acknowledge that. We actually need to be able to also be to flip that narrative and go, this isn't just some little cute story. They beat the Lakers fair and square. We're putting all this on AD and LeBron not playing great games. You know what? Yeah, they didn't. But you cannot tell me that if they were, you know, perfectly healthy and whatnot, that this team still couldn't have beat them. The Suns are that good.
Yeah, totally agree. I said going into the series, my brain said the Lakers because it's just LeBron and AD. It's hard to pick against them, but my heart wanted the Suns. And I'm with you, man. Like, if the Suns win this series, I will not be surprised. It should not be considered a huge upset. They are a very good team.
They're the higher seed. It literally could not be an upset.
Well, by Vegas it was, but
I am so tired of hearing about Vegas odds, though.
Well, you know, the odds makers are what they are. Okay, let's go to Knicks-Hawks, which I know you were burnt out by the end of this game, and you decided to play PlayStation instead. But
okay, let me because I know I was a little bit tired. A lot of basketball, been writing articles, been doing YouTube, just doing podcasting. I was a little bit burnt out by basketball, okay? I think that's fair. Just a little bit.
Yep.
And then I realized on PlayStation 5 that there is such a thing called EA Pass or something. It's from the Electronic Arts.
Oh, uh-huh.
So for a very, very small one-year fee, I could download FIFA and Madden. And you know what? I hadn't played Madden in like 12, 15 years. I was like, why not? And then I started playing Madden, Brian, and I chose the Bears because at the end of the day, I'm still one of those Chicago things. And here's what happened. I want to be very, very clear about this. Chicago fans will understand. Bears fans will listen to this and they'll go, yeah, I get it. That's totally reasonable. I drafted a quarterback who was 80th overall, and 2 weeks into the season, he was 87. And then he started getting better. And in the first year, Brian, I won the Super Bowl with my rookie quarterback. How could I not enjoy this? How could I not just ride that wave of momentum and just finish out the game so the Bears could win a Super Bowl with a rookie quarterback? Who also won league MVP, by the way. And I did not alter his stats whatsoever.
While you were doing that, Trae Young was silencing the Madison Square Garden crowd with a sensational performance. Really, like, I DM'd you last night. I said this was the game of the weekend, but then I thought, like, I remembered Bucks Heat. Like, okay, maybe not, but this was right up there. It was just like, especially in the fourth quarter, it was just haymaker after haymaker, big shot after big shot. These two trades.
And that is why I regret playing PlayStation.
Yeah, these two teams, it would, and with like the full Madison Square Garden crowd again, it was like, this was the first time in a year and a half I felt hope. It was like, oh, okay, yeah. The pandemic is ending. Like, things are getting back to normal. It was just so awesome. It was a great...
I did watch the Trae Young final shot, though.
Okay.
I did tune in. Like, I saw Twitter going, running amok. I don't even remember. Someone said, I think I might be watching the best playoff game ever.
Wow.
And I was like, okay. I don't know. I mean, I didn't watch the full game. Yeah. I was busy winning the Super Bowl.
It was not the best game ever. I'll say that much.
Okay, well, I'm very glad. But at the same, I figured, okay, I have to pause the game. I have to just go in and watch the two final possessions or three final possessions or whatever. And I saw Trae Young just do his thing. I was like, okay, yep, that... If this is the caliber of game I've missed, I regret it immensely.
Yeah. Well, the crowd chanted F Trae Young earlier, so his little like shush motion after he hit that last shot was
stay classy, Knicks fans.
Yeah, no, it was just a great game all around. Based on the scoring, based on, you know, it came down to one possession, these two teams seem pretty evenly matched. I want to ask from a Knicks perspective, because you could probably take two differing viewpoints here. One, Julius Randle is not likely to go 6 of 23 from the field again. Two, Alec Burks is not likely to score 27 points, 18 of which came in the fourth quarter again. So going into game two, Mort, if you're a Knicks fan, how are you feeling about this series?
Well, obviously, if I had home court and I don't defend home court in game one and I just fail to get my star established, I'm not feeling too hot.
Mm-hmm.
I'm not necessarily down on the Knicks whatsoever, but I'm not writing off this series whatsoever. I'm thinking that game two, you need to make a concerted effort in getting Randle going from the right spots immediately. Like, this cannot be another game that you hold tight or whatever. You have to come out like gangbusters in game two. Like, the energy has to be there. Randle has to go off. Like he had 15 points in game one. He has to have that in the first quarter in game two. Just really establish himself there. And then from there, let everyone else feed off of that energy, feed off the attention that he's getting. He's a good enough passer to be able to run the offense that way. And then Barrett, I mean, this was his first playoff game, so you know, for him to shoot poorly, it is what it is. But those two just need to step up a ton. I mean, what did the starting lineup score in totality? It wasn't a whole lot, right?
I'm for looking the Knicks? At the
box score.
Yeah.
20, 26, 15, 41 points?
41.
Is that right?
Yep.
That's not great.
No. I mean, big games from Burks and Rose off the bench.
Yep. And I'm sure that Frankie Smokes in his 1 minute where he was minus two is making our friend of the podcast, Dan Favalli, very, very happy.
Yeah.
Very happy. Yeah.
What do you think? Alfred Payton, 8 minutes, 0 of 3 from the field. Like,
yeah. So I wanted to ask you about that. Did he go down or was it just nope?
Nope. It's okay. Just you pulled the hook. I mean, Rose was, they put Rose in and he was really good, but. Like, why? I just don't understand why I continue with the charade of starting Alfred Payton.
No, that doesn't make a whole lot of sense. You were actually asking me about this before we went into the playoffs, and I told you Tibbs was going to stay with his guys, and sure hopefully this is going to change. If Rose is the best option, obviously he knows the system far more. There's also a reason that Taj Gibson played 24 minutes, I'm imagining, because those are just Tibbs. Solids.
Well, I mean, that, you know, 9 rebounds. He provided some nice physicality, especially on the glass. 5 offensive rebounds.
Oh, I don't
rebounds.
Doubt that.
Yeah.
I don't doubt that whatsoever, but I'm also saying, like, in a playoff context, Taj, having Rose there, who knows Tibbs' system in and out, I think that helps, right? So, I would probably be looking for Tibbs to... No, you know what? No, I'm not. I'm not looking for Tibbs to start Rose. I'm not. He won't. I refuse to believe he will. I just do.
Yeah. I don't think he will either, but man, I just don't. Unless it's like, if it's just a mental thing for Rose, like he's just so used to coming off the bench now and it helps him get prepared to like get eased in 4 minutes into the quarter and then play the rest of the half.
Yeah.
Sure, but
I guess.
Man, I don't know. I mean, we said going into the series that the Knicks conceptually didn't have a great answer for Trae Young, and one game in, it seems like that's the case. I mean, I think if you're a Hawks fan, you should be feeling phenomenal, because not only did you steal home court advantage, but I think you could reasonably expect, you know, Gallinari shot 3 of 11, John Collins only had 12 points, DeAndre Hunter looked good in his limited minutes, but yeah, he didn't score a ton, Capella only 9, like, I think you could reasonably expect a lot of these guys to provide more than they did in game 2, so...
While Trey delivers the same, honestly.
Yeah, right. Yeah. So, you know, I picked the Hawks going into this series, and nothing I saw in game 1 makes me want to back off of that pick. I feel...
Yeah, it does seem reasonable, especially now that they took home court as well. And I also like just the Hawks' makeup overall. I do wonder, and again, this is me asking you because I only saw the later stages of the game.
Mm-hmm.
DeAndre Hunter and John Collins.
Yeah.
So normally Collins is a high-volume shooter.
Mm-hmm.
Is one of the reasons that he wasn't in this game because he was guarding Randle? Like, was he rededicating some of his efforts on Randle?
Let me double-check the exact... I mean, yes, both of those guys were taking the Randle matchup at times. I want to see who had him the most. I will say, I mean, it just felt like a lot of the offense was flowing through Young and then Bogdanovich in particular, who was really good in this game.
But I'm just thinking defensively because if you know, let me finish my thought here as well, because while you research, because my thinking is here, despite John Collins not being a great individual defender, mm-hmm. he's got great size and athleticism. So maybe that is enough. Like if the Hawks just go, you know what, John, we got enough offense. We got so many guys who can get up shots. Just be one of those opportunistic scorers, but at the same time, use your athleticism to really just bog down Randle. And again, this is where you can answer me just how much time he spent on Randle. I don't know.
Collins had the most. It was between Collins, Gallo, and Hunter were the three main guys, but Collins had the most time on him.
Let me guess. Without having watched the game, Randle did most of his work against Gallo.
I mean, I don't remember who. Let me see. No, actually, most of it was against Collins.
That was against Collins?
Yeah, 4 of 8 against Collins, 1 of 6 against Gallo, 1 of 5 against Hunter.
Wow, 1 of 6 against Gallo? That's interesting. Well, I mean, of course, small sample size, but...
He didn't get a ton of free throws. Like, he wasn't... A lot of it was, like, him trying to operate in the mid-range rather than draw contact and getting in the... close to the basket. I think Capella's presence there didn't help. I think it was hard for him to get going.
Right.
So I'm curious to see how he adjusts his offensive approach going into game 2.
Well, if he shot 50% against Collins, granted it's on small sample size, that does ruin my theory a little bit, because I just think someone like Collins, who's 6'9", really quick on his feet, despite not having great, what's the word here I'm looking for, defensive IQ, I think. He just didn't really think the game out defensively. Athletically, he's supreme. Like you, from a physicality standpoint, you probably couldn't build a player more suitable to really limit Julius Randle.
Right. Yeah, and Randle had him for most of... I mean, Randle was his primary defender as well. So
okay.
Yeah. All right, Moy, let's wrap up with Jazz Grizzlies. We got a surprise going into this game because Donovan Mitchell, you know, was sounding like he was going to be ready for game 1. Mike Conley said he was going to be ready for game 1. Donovan Mitchell was not ready for game 1. He did not play in this game. And the Memphis Grizzlies walk away with a 112-109 upset. Dylan Brooks, who we have criticized a number of times this year for his iffy shot selection, deserves a ton of credit. 31 points, a team-high 31 points on 13 of 26 shooting. Ja Morant also had 26 points. Jonas Valanciunas, our boy, you got your wish. He played 39 minutes. He did not put up a 20-20, but he did have 15 and 12.
Well, he was against Rudy Gobert. So you know what? I will take 15 and 12 against Rudy Gobert.
Okay, that's fair. And Kyle Anderson, 6 steals as well. I mean, the Jazz, they got decent production out of their main guys. Conley didn't shoot super well. 6 of 18 from the floor. But, you know, it felt as simple as they just really missed Mitchell in this game. And I think it's, you know, we both picked the Jazz to win, I think, in 5. But you did hedge to say that depends on Mitchell's status. So,
yeah.
I think a lot of this just comes down to when is he coming back? We don't know. I mean, he just tweeted this morning, I saw, that said, like, I wish I could say more, but I'll be back soon.
Yeah. Oh, God. That doesn't sound too encouraging.
Yeah. I mean, this is a series if he's not back.
Yeah. Yeah. It sure is. And, all right. So, a couple points. Let me just first and foremost talk about Dylan Brooks.
Yeah.
So, over the past, I want to say 2 weeks.
Mm-hmm.
He's been way more like offensively inclined. Like,
yes.
He's just been shooting. At no point during the month of May has he hit 50% of his shots in a single game. He's actually last night, not with Sandy, when he was exactly at 50%, but in the regular season. So I do think it's fair to still say once in a while, just in terms of his Kobe shot selection, that maybe just take 4 of those shots per game away. Just don't take those. But at the same time, I think the Memphis Grizzlies need the volume right now. Mm-hmm. I think they need someone who, from the perimeter, can consistently create something.
Yeah.
And maybe even if he isn't superbly efficient, we're going the old Allen Iverson route of just having to create certain looks that changes how your defense operates. So if Dylan Brooks is doing just that, fine, I'll live with it. But if he goes into one of the games in this series and shoots like 4 of 21, that is going to be a major, major hurdle. And that's when you kind of want to pivot over to Valanciunas or Morant. Well, maybe not Valanciunas specifically against Gobert, yeah, but then maybe Jaren Jackson Jr. So, like, I still consider him a wild card. What I will say about Dylan Brooks, this was my point about him, defensively, though.
Yes.
Defensively, he's turned the corner. I did a video on the Grizzlies, I want to say a week and a half ago, and I said in the video I wouldn't be shocked if the Grizzlies were open to moving him during the offseason to get someone in who's more reliable. But I'm actually thinking that I'm going to step away from that, from that theory, because they just need the defense. They need, despite the inconsistencies offensively, they just need the two-way production from the wing. And he does provide them that. I think he's a great balancer for the volume of Valanciunas and Morant specifically. And also, Jaren Jackson Jr. is just not back yet. He's just not. So right now, they need everything they can get for him. So, yeah, ultimately, good on Memphis for this one. But moving forward, I really want them to see someone else in the lineup take some of those shots away from Dylan Brooks so it doesn't become a problem if he goes into a shooting slump.
Right, yeah. He was, in the two playing games, he was 10 of 21. He had 24 points in the Grizzlies' win over the Spurs. So that was, it's almost like a low-key version of good Russ, good Dylan, bad Dylan. Because that was good Dylan. And then in the win over the Warriors, the winner-go-home game, 14 points on 7 of 22 shooting. So that was not great Dylan, but that, as you said, he does provide, you know, when bad Russ comes out, it's like a full-on catastrophe, because it's like the bad shot selection, the bad defense, the turnovers, like just completely destroys your team. Dylan Brooks, even when he is missing shots and taking 20-plus and shooting 30%, he is going to give you the good defense either way. He's going to give you like the competitiveness, the physicality. Russ does that too, to his credit. You know, you're always going to get rebounds, the assists with Russ. There are good parts to his game, but bad Dylan is not as catastrophic as bad Russ.
Exactly.
But yes, very good Dylan Brooks game, and hopefully that continues. I was also just impressed with Morant. I mean, I figured, you know,
he's ready.
Yeah, well, I mean, we said going into the series that, you know, having Gobert, like, this is a really bad matchup for Memphis, because Gobert can neutralize Jonas Valanciunas. Gobert can neutralize Ja Morant, who likes to go to the basket, isn't a great three-point shooter. You know, you're taking away one of his big strengths. And at least in game one, that wasn't really the case.
Well, Gobert was in foul trouble as well. I mean, he fouled up in 20, 25 minutes, so that probably plays a part, I think.
Yes.
But overall, I agree with you, and I think Rudy has had significantly better games than what he showed.
Yeah. Also, the Jazz shot only 12 of 47 from three-point range, so I'm sure Charles Barkley had a field day with, can't be a jump-shooting team, win a playoff series.
You know what's funny about that? It's, by the way, did you just
nope.
bash a colleague?
I didn't watch it. I was long asleep.
No. I'm just saying you don't get fired, Brian.
I know.
No, but I'm glad to hear some Barkley slander. So here's a funny thing. He said that all the way back in 2007. Actually, 2006. This has been a mantra of his for the past 15 years.
Oh, I was just going back. I mean, this was his thing with the Warriors especially.
And yeah, no, but he used to say it with the Scott Skiles Bulls
back in the day. Okay.
Yeah, with Ben Gordon and Kirk Heinrich. Mm. So this is like a mantra that started all the way back there. So kudos to Charles Barkley for 15 years not having to refresh his browser at any point or just update his own software setting. That takes a level of commitment to being stupid. Well done, Chuck.
It's consistency, if nothing else. That is impressive. Yeah.
Consistently stupid. Good on you, Chuck, for being consistently dumb.
I will say, the odds makers still have the Jazz as -325 favorites, so they are not. Vegas odds makers do not seem particularly concerned about this game because, as you noted, Gobert fouls out. You know, the Jazz shoot horrifically from three, and
yeah,
you know they took 47 threes. Memphis took 20. Like, math is going to win out most nights, especially if Mitchell comes back. So I'm not concerned for Utah yet. I think this is mostly just a good story, an awesome experience for the Grizzlies young guys. It's something they can build on. And yeah, I mean, I think, you know, not having full strength Jaren Jackson Jr., like full power Jaren Jackson Jr. is going to hurt them in this series. But
Brian, how could the Jazz lose when they had a six man who can score the basketball?
Two.
How on earth?
Well, because they moved their other six man. They needed their two super six men. They only had one.
But still, I mean, Jordan Clarkson can score the basketball, so that means that he is the best thing coming off the bench since sliced bread, obviously. His 5 of 16 and 0 for 8 from downtown. Oh, Lord behold, that. Why didn't they win the game?
He continued his second half trend of having horrific shooting percentages. Mm-hmm. So that's good.
The power of the six man is never to be beaten. Look, this is where someone like Desmond Bane, I would much rather have a guy like him. Oh, hey, look, even D'Anthony Melton, even though he had a very bad offensive game, but let's just stick with Desmond Bane. 8 points, 4 rebounds. He's 3 of 4 from the field. That's the offensive part. Defensively, he can switch on to multiple positions. He can make passes. He's an active rebounder. I would take so many guys over a Jordan Clarkson archetype if we're talking about six man. I had to get that in there.
Yeah. And plus 23, a team high plus 23 in the game.
There you go. I didn't even look at that. Yep.
All right. Well, that's a good place for us to wrap up. So thank you all, as always, for listening. Hope you enjoyed the first weekend of the playoffs. We will be back soon. We have some Bye Felicias to get to for the play-in teams. We'll also just be reacting to whatever happens throughout these series. A lot of big game twos already, which is not something you can say every day. But, I mean, a lot of upsets so far. And we'll see if the home teams can even these series up, or they're going to be in a lot of trouble going into Game 3. In the meantime, please follow us on Twitter at the NBA Pod. You can find our Twitter handles in our bio, so give us a follow as well. You can also find us on iTunes and wherever else podcasts are found. On iTunes, please subscribe, download, leave some 5-star reviews. Being hosted by Spreaker, so check them out on Twitter at Spreaker. And thanks for listening to our live show on Locker Room. If you liked our show, please be sure to start your own room and engage with other fans on the app. Download the Locker Room app in the Apple App Store to be a part of our podcast. Until next time, I'm Brian Toporek, and I was joined, as always, by Morten Jensen. Have a good one, Mort.
You too, Brian. I can't wait to see Ben Simmons start up next game with a strong drive and a left-handed hammer, and then have another 2 field goals for the rest of the game.
He did take 1-3, I'll say that much. He's going to hit one in the playoffs.
You can't see this, people, but I'm slow clapping.
All right, later, Mort.
Later.